Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's podcast, we are joined by Kyle Lopez-Schmidt, an architect and organizer and the executive director of the South Tower Community Land Trust. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So in the last month, you've had a lot of wins, congratulations, in South Tower that have been many years in the making. There's the San Pablo Park, which is a difficult spot under the 180 freeway that you guys have really helped collaborate with local artists to turn into a mural haven. The opening of a new park, Broadway Parque, on Broadway and Elizabeth, where a police station once stood. And also you just launched the Community Land Trust's first home on the market. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
So we'll talk about all of those things. But before we get into the South Tower stuff, one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you on the podcast is I've known you for, I think, almost 2 decades now, maybe.
Yeah, and I'm excited that we've collaborated and worked through. We've thought leaders together about a lot of this stuff in Fresno. So
it's been a journey, and it's been fun for me to watch you evolve and change your approach. You've been an organizer since I've known you, probably since you were probably 10 years old, maybe even earlier.
No, I think it started more returning to Fresno after Cal. I think that's when I started leaning into that.
Yeah. And so I'd love to just get more into your history and your approach and how that's changed. So after you moved back to Fresno, after attending Cal, what was the first project that kind of got you going into working in community organizing here locally?
Yeah, there was two things. Got in pretty close with Creative Fresno, and they really caught my eye as folks that were doing work downtown.
I don't know much about Creative Fresno. What was that?
Yeah, so this was like 2005, 2006.
Do you remember Richard Florida?
Yes. Yeah,
so the theory of change is creative cities movement around if cities could make their environment more attractive to creative professionals and successful for creative professionals, that there'll be a impact on all individuals. And I think Richard Ford has debunked some of his own theories.
Yes.
But it was an interesting organizing principle around getting a lot of creative professionals in Fresno involved in downtown, involved in Tower District things. They led a mural. Many reasons why the mural district is now the mural district is the collaboration between Reza and Creative Fresno and creating so many murals there. And I brought to them an idea of doing an event called Pachakacha Night, which is like a creative presentation idea that came out of Tokyo that was led by an architect, where they would do these presentations where you'd present 20 slides, 20 seconds each, so you had just under 7 minutes to give like a pitch. So it was this kind of PowerPoint karaoke feel to it. And so I brought them that idea and they embraced it. And so we held that event for several years.
Those were really fun.
Yeah.
You missed some good times in Fresno, Jordan.
Then the other space I got involved with, because I was working in architecture, the local American Institute of Architects San Joaquin chapter, I brought them an idea called Arc Hop, where we would, on Art Hop nights, we would do architecture-themed exhibits and installations. And we did that for a few years. So those were like the two kind of first things that I dove into when I got back to Fresno.
And then over time, I'm curious about tactics. We want to talk about a lot about organizing from a tactical perspective. How's that evolved? And what do you think are the kind of the push and pull factors to get you to change your approach?
Yeah, I think it's been like additive, that I haven't necessarily changed the approach, but been able to add more tools. And more specifically, relationships are very important in organizing and understanding how to build and maintain relationships over time, especially when you're fighting for something that is a long goal or you're not necessarily winning all the time. It can be difficult to make sure that you're maintaining positive relationships with people that you're organizing with and for. So that's one of the major challenges. And I think one change over time, I'm very fiery person. I'm a double Aries comes into this as a picture where I'm ready to fight and I'm ready to get riled up about something, and just mellowed a little bit in my aging, but not too much. I've gotten to balance it a little more and known where anger and where fighting is like the appropriate response.
You're not known locally, at least in my perception, as a person who pulls punches when speaking to elected officials or whoever you're trying to hold accountable. You've spoke at city council many times and said some really straightforward criticisms directly to the council on the dais. And I'm curious, how has that sometimes directly confrontational approach been helpful, and when has that not been helpful for you?
Yeah, it's a hard question because I hold a lot of strong value in being anti-racist, being anti-capitalist, being an abolitionist. Like, those are strong values that are hard to compromise on. And so when confronted with things that are very much in conflict with what my goals are for our neighborhood and our society, it doesn't feel right to compromise those things. And if the compromise to that is that you don't get what you want or what we need, then why are we compromising, is how I view it.
When you're doing that confrontational approach, are you more speaking to the community or are you speaking to the council members you're addressing? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to think that the council members are part of the community and they have to listen to the community, whether they follow that direction all the time or not, but they are members of it. They have a position that has power to it. And in this work, speaking truth to power and confronting power so that we're trying to pull more power into community, into more direct community control. And so that's where sometimes you need to take the fight, take the confrontation.
Do you have any examples you can think of where you have been directly confrontational with a public official and they've been responsive in a positive way as a result of that?
Oof.
That was kind of the subtext of my question. Yeah.
The saga of Broadway Parque, I think, is a very good example. This was organizing that started in 2017 when we found out that the city was putting forward to rezone the police station from a public facility zoning to a residential facility, residential zoning, without any communication with the community and through a method that's not typical for a rezone. So it was just shady, bundling it with a general plan cleanup zoning process.
How did you even learn that this was happening?
Yeah, so it was sitting on the Tower District specific plan or Tower District Design Review Committee, where we review land use changes, building permits for the Tower District. And that's the place that this general plan cleanup application came that had 12 or 13 properties across the city. Three of them were in the Tower District. And one was where the Johnny Quick is now. That was zoned mixed use, and the developer, the Johnny Quick, wanted it to be general commercial because a liquor store or gas station wouldn't be allowed in mixed use. And that would be our 12th liquor store in that census tract, which should only have 6 by law. So that was an interesting one to fight against, which we didn't win. And then another was the City of Fresno property that had been zoned public facilities for decades and was not changed in the general plan. And so that's why it was weird that it would be in with this general plan cleanup. So that's where we took that to our council members at the time, who were Oliver Baines and Esmeralda Soria. They were both supportive of not rezoning it and giving us time to talk to the community and have community involved in the process. So that was a testament to them. And then when Miguel Arias came into office, his communication to me was like, we'll give you one shot to raise the money from a state grant to make the park happen. If you don't get that, we're going to move on because there's no money for parks in Fresno right now. And so that's where had to just say, okay, we'll take our shot, but we're not going to stop working on that. And thank you for that shot, but we're going to keep the right thing to do is continue to fight for a park here. And it's good that we did, because Measure P came around and the court reversed the decision on Measure P, where that funding started getting collected and allocated. So through that period of failing at our first chance for the state grant and Measure P being reversed, we were at battle with Miguel Arias because he wanted to see something else happen there, didn't want to wait, and wanted to get that property off of the City of Fresno's books and get it into the hands of a developer. And we obviously disagreed with that. And so we had to like battle and have some tactics on how to make that happen. And through that.
Yeah, how do you win him over?
The Measure P was the whole thing. Once there was money for a park, then yeah, it became an obvious pathway forward. And It allowed our community to get what it wanted and allowed the city to have a win with a new park in the neighborhood, in a very park-poor neighborhood. We had a third of an acre for every 1,000 residents, and our general plan calls for over 3 acres per 1,000 residents. Right. So we've got a pretty big deficit, and it's hard to find spaces for parks in existing neighborhoods. That's where it was an obvious choice for us.
Yes. And how have, one thing that has been interesting to watch in your journey, Kyle, is I feel like you've gone from being a person who advocates for the community or advocates for different causes, as obviously it's part of your identity, but you've had different jobs over the years, and now you've gone to starting the South Tower Community Land Trust. And so now it's not just about you, it's about bringing the neighborhood and the residents along. And so how has that journey looked like for you to go from sort of advocacy to organizing?
Yeah, it's been a journey. And some specific things in my leadership journey is working on Broadway Park A in the neighborhood, realizing that we needed more than me as a leader to be able to advance these things in our neighborhood and to give it more life beyond what I could give it. So that was part of that realization, that we needed to create an organization to hold this work and to multiply it. And recruiting a board from some of the folks that were advocating for Broadway Park A with me and other leaders that I've seen in the neighborhood that could benefit the organization and also could benefit by being part of it, and recruiting folks and helping them mature in their leadership has been really amazing. We've got 8 members on our board that each one of them is an amazing leader with an amazing story, and like really excited to be working with each of them. And then the staff that we've been able to build, it's not just me doing this work. We have a 4-person team all working full time with full benefits and 4-day work week, and like we're really creating some interesting work culture, and each one of our team members is bringing their all to this work, and we're doing some cool stuff.
I want to ask you something that I've also experienced. I'm curious, as a white man operating in these spaces, how you think that is either sometimes helped your approach in community organization, and then there's also challenges to it too, where you go into non-white communities where they've had white community organizers come through with big ideas to how to change the neighborhood. How do you think maybe help and hinder your identity?
I really appreciate that question, and being not just white, but white male presenting is one thing that helps is I am organizing in my community where I grew up. And so that's helps bridge some of that. It takes a lot of learning and knowing when our biases are really showing up, and it's hard to see those unless you really spend the time and analyze it and reflect on your own self and do reading and listen to other people is really big parts of that. The other is helping foster other leaders and making sure that we're identifying folks of other genders, women, non-binary, trans folks that need that mentorship to grow into being incredible leaders, growing leaders in the Black community, Latino leaders, Indigenous leaders, like seeing them and finding ways that I can use my privilege to advance their goals. We talk about it sometimes as weaponizing our privilege to benefit the community, where I can get into spaces, I can have relationships that they don't have access to, and I can use that to hold open the door and make space for folks to succeed.
That's something I say a lot. You got to spend it. If you have the privilege, use it. Don't let it sit, because it doesn't roll over.
Yeah, and you and I have both seen, all of us have seen people who are, especially if you're a woman and a Latina in this town or a Black woman, like the being confrontational has a different end result in a lot of times for a lot of women. And I think it's like acknowledging where that comes from is really important. And figuring out how we go from there.
I want to talk about the park now. I've got some questions. I'm fascinated by this Surplus Land Act and actually what it's like to implement it and go through the process. I'm curious for you, what was that like, and what are some of the bottlenecks you encountered? Yeah,
can you first explain what
Give us the background.
So California passed a law called the California Surplus Land Act, which mandates all government institutions across the state to identify what land and properties in their inventory, in their asset list, are surplus that don't have an identified use, and to make those available for first either nonprofit or government entities doing government buildings, parks, and affordable housing are the like three buildings that are in the priority list of that. And if any entity wants to sell any of their property, they have to first offer it through those, so offer it to a nonprofit or another government entity to do one of those three projects. It's got some loopholes and things that different cities are able to utilize because they're not mandated to go through a certain process from the state, but they're mandated to create their own process. So when we started with Broadway Parque, that was either not in force or the city hadn't adopted a Surplus Land Act process. So in the beginning, they were just going to quietly rezone it and then give or sell it to a developer for market rate apartment building there. But when we got involved in the process and it delayed for a while, that's when California Surplus Land Act came into effect. And so once we had gone through our first grant application and got denied and the city was going to move forward with other options, they had to then follow that process where they put out an RFP that says, here's the property, here's what it's valued at, make offers for park or affordable housing development. And we put together an offer. At the time, we weren't an organization, so we worked with the Lowell Community Development Corporation to offer $1 to the city of Fresno, and we committed to raising funds to build a park, and if not, to develop affordable housing. And so that was what we proposed. I don't know all of what happened in the background in City Hall, but I think we were the only offer, and it ground things to a halt because they didn't want to sell it to us. And
the developer didn't put in an offer?
It had to first be affordable housing, and the developer wanted to do market rate.
Okay.
And you get, that's like 90 days or something.
Yeah, that range. And yeah. So it just stopped, and it became like crickets, like we were trying to find out what was happening. And in that kind of waiting time of several months is when Measure P went to the ballot and then got reversed. So we were like continuing to ask and advocate for it to be a park through that process, but nothing was coming to us from City Hall, no communication. So we didn't actually end up owning the property. And part of it was like dog catching the car. It was like we wouldn't really want to own the land because developing a park and operating a park is no way to really make that revenue neutral. It's always going to be losing money from an expense side. And so that would be a hard thing for our nonprofit of having to continue to raise money to operate a privately owned park. So glad that the city ended up having a method to do that, but it was part of our strategy and it was effective. And I don't think there's a lot of, I know there's one other parcel that City of Fresno owned in South Tower that we're told by them that it's exempt from the Surplus Land Act because it's small enough. So
I think it's like anything under half acre is exempt.
We haven't been able to like break that one loose yet, but we're also not really ready for it. Over time, we'll see if we can challenge that.
Interesting. So that's a good transition to talking about land ownership and how South Tower has formed around the community land trust model. Can you explain that approach to our listeners, and what does the community mean in the community land trust model?
Yeah, and there's first important to recognize that across the state and country, different community land trusts approach it a little differently and have different strategies. There are some things that kind of tie them together. One of them is in board structure. The community land trust model calls for 1/3 of your board members to be residents of the community land trust's property, 1/3 to come from the broader community around that, and then the other 1/3 can be professionals that advance the work, realtors, architects, bankers, finance people, accountants, the normal folks that help nonprofits operate and raise money and things like that. So that's the board structure. We don't currently have any residents in our property. We didn't have anybody to put in that first 1/3 that's residents. 2/3 of our board is just from the property around. Some of them are residents of affordable housing projects like the 541 at South Tower development that's owned by Fresno Housing. One of our board members lives there. So we tried to identify some low-income residents that had some similar perspectives that our residents of the property would have. So that's one aspect in kind of the governance. The other aspect is in how you approach affordable housing development. And some folks will have different strategies on whether you're going towards multifamily and apartments or single family homes or a mix of both. And some even approaching it, looking at commercial and community ownership in that lens. But a key thing in making it more affordable is that our community land trust will continue to own land, and we will only sell the improvements on the land. So we are, if we own land that has a home on it, we'll sell the home but retain ownership of the land and enter into a 99-year renewable land lease with the owner that sets out the terms of what our collaboration is together, which is basically that they own the home and they maintain the home and they can improve the home, and we're there as a support mechanism and we own the land. But if they want to go and sell the home, that they sell it at the same affordability that they bought it. It doesn't mean it's going to be the exact same price, because affordability can change over time, where if area median income goes up, the price of their, the value of the home will also go up in the same ratio.
What's the importance of this kind of model in a neighborhood like South Tower? Could you kind of describe South Tower?
Yeah, so South Tower we generally define as south of Olive, north of the 180. And there's a lot of renters in the neighborhood. I believe the neighborhood is about 65%, maybe 70% renters, and then the 30% or 35% homeowners. That's not a healthy balance. A healthier balance would be closer to 50-55% homeowners. And
are these long-term renters, or do you see a lot of kind of transient movement?
There's a mix. I think there's folks that have rented their homes for long times. There's people that move in and out more regularly. There are significant amount of slumlord housing in the neighborhood that's just substandard housing that nobody should be living in. It should be improved, but we have predatory capitalists in our neighborhood. And so with that many renters, we want to find ways that folks that are not necessarily earning enough to be able to buy a home on the market have an opportunity to get into a home. So by having, a perfect example is this Ferris house that we just listed for sale right now. It's a 2-bedroom, 2-bath home. We bought it for $250,000 from an investor that was trying to flip it, but had it on the market for over 6 months and nobody was buying it. So we purchased it for $250,000, did a little over $50,000 of improvements. We put a new roof on it, new air conditioner, the kind of things that flippers don't do, the big investments yeah. that are hard to see.
Non-cosmetic. But are
really, yeah, they're really there to be a good investment long-term for a homeowner. We did those things, and so our total cost in is about $300,000, but we're gonna sell the home for $215,000. So this is a value that getting a move-in ready home in the Tower District with air conditioning and a new roof for in that quality in that part of the neighborhood is probably in the neighborhood of $300,000, if not a little bit more. And so being able to have somebody get into a home like that for below that is makes it more accessible for somebody that might be renting that's on the cusp of being able to afford a home.
Yeah, what's the leasing process look like for someone that would live there?
Yeah, so it's on the market and we have a realtor. There's an open house. I don't know if this is how fast it's coming out, but on the 9th and 10th of August, we have two open houses, and anybody that's wanting to make that their home would have their own realtor. They can tour through the home either during our open house or their realtor could bring them through. And then they'd make an offer. We're not looking for offers above or below what we're asking. And if we do end up with multiple qualified offers, we'll basically do a lottery of who fits in that. And we're following California Fair Housing standards. We can't review like who these people's identities are and what are their race or their work jobs or anything. It's just what's their financing? Do they qualify? And then they're making a selection from there. So if anybody has a realtor already and is looking, it's a good time for them to come through and look at it. If they don't have a realtor yet, talk to their friends and get a recommendation, or come to the open house and get a recommendation from our realtor and see if this can work out for you. The other thing in that's available, different organizations do, you know, credit repair, homeownership readiness. There's even some really amazing like down payment assistance programs where you can get up to $40,000 for down payment assistance through certain banks if you go through an educational program. I know Southwest Fresno Development Corporation offers a lot of that. So they're a good resource for plugging into and getting yourself ready for buying a home.
So one of the, and I don't think this is a critique you're unfamiliar with from me, but one of the critiques of the community land trust model is just this difficulty to scale And amazing that, you know, someone in Fresno who can't afford a home on the market could buy at 215. But how do you, or how have community land trusts found ways to meet the demand when I think Fresno County has a shortage of over 30,000 affordable homes?
Yeah.
Where do you start?
I would first start with, we need lots of solutions to housing. Community Land Trust is one of them. This kind of toolbox that we're bringing to this, it's one that aligns very closely with my values. So it's where I'm putting a lot of my energy. There are community land trusts across the state that own dozens and if not hundreds of units in their portfolio. So there's the opportunity to grow it and scale it. And some examples that I'd point to that are growing right now is City of Bakersfield decided to put a lot of investment into a community land trust. And so they created one and they partnered with Self-Help Enterprises to help develop and operate that. And they just broke ground on a development. I think they're hoping to do about 100 units over time. So it could have an impact for us. We have two homes right now that we've purchased. This one that we're selling, we're starting renovations on the other. We strategically bought them with like big backyards that face a new street being built by high-speed rail, that we're going to build two new homes that face that street. We also own a vacant lot in the neighborhood where we have a plan to do six cottages, like small units on one site that will all be home ownership as well, but very small homes, one-bedroom homes, studio homes, where we'll be able to look at a very different demographic that didn't think that they would achieve home ownership by buying a two-bedroom house or whatever. Buying a one-bedroom home for $100,000 seems like opens up a lot more opportunities for people. So that's how we're approaching it. I think this first year we're going to have these two homes. Next year we'll be adding, maybe before the end of the year we'll have eight. It might take us into the next year before we get eight. And doing about two renovations a year and looking at new development as well. So I think we're going to make an impact over time. It's not the same as a 50-unit low-income housing tax credit project, but those are all rentals as well. So we're really looking at empowering people with ownership that wouldn't be able to achieve it otherwise through these kind of creative tools.
Yeah, I'm curious about wealth generation. That's often a goal in a lot of communities, is how do we build that? And like it or not, like something like 70% of Americans' wealth is just contained in the equity in their home.
Yep.
How do you think about that as it relates to what you do in terms of generational wealth as a goal on one side and home ownership on the other side?
Yeah, I agree that generational wealth is an important thing. I think sometimes it's held up in a way that's a little bit mythological, that if you really look at over the spectrum, the amount of people that own homes is not accelerating as much as like corporate ownership of homes, and we're continuing to have more and more assets in the hands of corporations and hedge funds and Chinese corporations, and so there's less and less homes that are in the hands of individuals and families, and so that has been whittled away, and so we need like tools to figure out how we can reverse that. And also, we have an unrealistic expectation that a home automatically increases in value at a pace that is unsustainable. And some neighborhoods get to benefit from that with their home values continuing to escalate, and then other disinvested neighborhoods don't. And you have kind of areas of Fresno that the homes don't go up in value as much, or have too much inventory that's just substandard where it's not equitable. And so with our model, your home value is not going to increase as much as the homes around you in the Tower District, but hoping that balances with getting somebody in with that wouldn't have been able to buy a home in the first place.
So it's like a trade-off.
Yeah.
For not being, you get some appreciation.
Yeah, and you still build equity. So you've got a mortgage, and every payment that you make is reducing your principal balance. And so you are gaining equity. And when you do sell that home, you'll have equity to put into your next home, or you don't have to sell the home. You could stay in it for as long as you want, and you could even leave it to your family, your heirs, and not have to worry about that. But if you did want to sell it, then you know it's not the same return that you would get from something that is a traditional home loan.
Yeah. Sure. So can you just, for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, give us your unfiltered thoughts on SATA? Go. Jordan. I'm just Zeta. Kidding. I'm no, just and, kidding.
The tie-in, and I think this ties into
Measure C. I was just trying to hit Donnie's notes. Let's this get on Seda
into, for... like Measure C, too, is our neighborhood was pretty dramatically and negatively impacted by the 180 freeway construction, which was, yeah. by and large, funded by Measure C and was a mechanism to enable sprawl in the west side of Fresno as well as, more significantly, the east side of Fresno. And Seda is... exactly in line with that, and some of their justification is that the freeway is already there and we should right. build it out, and we get to be a neighborhood that the freeway cuts right across, really hindered Belmont in some significant ways and enabled industrial expansion in our neighborhood that's at the detriment of our neighborhood health. And Seda and Measure C both have a weird taste in my mouth. I hope Measure C could be more equitable and invest more in multimodal things and not freeways, because our neighborhood feels the legacy of that investment.
How do you feel like you guys have made a lot of really great progress in the last few months in projects that show that there is investment back in South mm-hmm. Tower, San Pablo Park, Broadway Parquet, of course? What kind of message does that send to investors? Does it deter them because you're trying to cool off the market, or does it in some weird way bring even more investment because they're seeing some public dollars coming into the community?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I don't think we don't hold enough property to really influence developers in that way. The park investment, I think it could be attractive to developers because properties near parks have higher values and tend to be safer and more attractive for folks. The balance there is there's not a lot of vacant property in the neighborhood to new sure. develop. You could certainly buy homes and flip them and make a profit that way, which is already happening. I don't think we're having an influence. Probably the federal economy and global economy and interest rates have more to effect on that than we ever could.
Sure. No, that's fair. That's fair. What advice would you give to people who want to take more control over their neighborhood and to start working with their neighborhoods to change the course of their community?
Yeah, I would say it's worth it. The end result is amazing, but also the process of being in community with folks, getting to know where you share vision with folks, and being in battle together definitely creates a unity. And even when you do get those successes, it's a lot of fun and a lot of celebration that happens and a lot of gratitude. So I would say it's worth it. Keep a lookout in what's happening in your neighborhood and try to find people that want to have a similar input and impact.
And I think it could be small. Like I lived in Altadena for 4 years, and I lived in a part that needed some work. Mm-hmm. And there was this median just right outside of my neighborhood on the street called Woodbury. And I just weeded the median once a week. And I think something small like that,
yeah.
that goes a long way. I think sometimes our eyes get big and we feel like we need
too.
To solve everything.
You see somebody yeah. out in your neighborhood trying to do something and other people are drawn in. And that's what happened with our major event that we've started, the Queer Housing Summit. We were wanting to, for our own organization, come up with a strategy of how we're housing the LGBTQ+ community in the Tower District, because it's a really important part of our community that is more marginalized and has a hard time with ownership and with discrimination and things like that. And so we wanted to start doing that, so we held our Queer Housing Summit in 2023. It's like can we come together to figure out a strategy? And then other people were drawn in by this, and we now have our third annual Queer Housing Summit, August 23rd at Fresno City College. That is now a national conference. Like, we've got national speakers coming to Fresno. We have people coming to attend at the national level. We've raised over $40,000 for this event to put it on in an equitable way, where we're paying people to plan the event with us. We're paying speakers stipends that we're not like extracting from the community. And so those are the kinds of things that you can do just by putting the effort in.
We close these podcasts in the same place each week with what we're loving this week. We're going to start with Kyle. Kyle, what are you loving this week?
Man, I'm loving my neighborhood. The Tower District is a really special place, and I get a lot of gratification out of making an impact and having something there that's tangible, that's going to last. And so just hanging out in Broadway Parque, hearing kids play.
Are people playing chess on those chess squares?
There is people playing chess. We're going to get like a free library eventually and have a part of that be some chess pieces and checkers for people to be able to play the games. So just hanging out there has been great. After this, I'm going for our park committee meeting, at our first committee meeting in the park, and we've been meeting for over 8 years to try and make it happen. So it'll be our celebratory committee meeting in the park.
I'll go next. This week, I have this kind of weird like dual thing where I'm both afraid of hospitals, but I also want to watch like hospital docuseries. And so I've been watching this. It's set in the UK, in London. It's a show called Critical. And it just follows like trauma centers. It's basically they take a person from the ambulance all the way through surgery to recovery. Mm. And it's been so fascinating. Half the episodes are heartbreaking.
It's a documentary.
It's like a docuseries. So you're just in the trauma centers, like watching them.
My sister would eat this up.
It's so good. There was one episode, I'm not gross out warning here. Someone gets into an altercation where they have some fractures right above their eye socket.
Okay.
And in the show, you watch the surgeon essentially peel their scalp all the way off down to their nose. Mm-mm. And it's just, and I wasn't eating anything when I was watching it, but my eyes were glued. I was like enthralled by what I was watching.
But speaking of food, and I know you like food, is go to Clovis Community Hospital and go to their cafe there. The food is excellent. Shout out to Chef Tino.
Yes.
Whoa. Yes.
Have you not heard this?
No.
I have friends that go on dates to Clovis Community to eat. Absolutely. That and Living Spaces. Those are the secret spots.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God. This is blowing my mind right now.
Okay. Dottie, what are you loving?
I don't have any secret. I'll have to think about my secret date spots that are not date spots, but none come to mind. Mm. But what I'm loving this week is, so I think last week I talked about how my son play soccer now. I'm a soccer mom, have the like card now, but my son has decided to become my trainer. And so he wakes me up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Good morning, sleepyhead. And then that's what he says. And then he forces me to go on a mile run with him every morning this week. I hit my best time yesterday. It was very exciting. I haven't done my run today yet because we had to leave a little bit earlier. So I'll do it later today in the heat.
It's going
to
be hot.
If I don't do it with him, I have to send him a screenshot of my time on my watch. Oh, wow. So he's very hardcore trainer. Yeah. So if anyone wants a 10-year-old running trainer, I got one for you.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.